Hits.
Hello, and welcome to Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. It's April 3rd, 2016. It was on this day in 2010 that the Apple Computer Company released the iPad. Now, here's what's ahead on today's program. In our weekly higher education report, we will look at the new Scholastic Aptitude Tests, or SATs. They're used by colleges and universities as entrance exams. Hundreds of thousands of high school students took the redesigned test last month. We spoke with some of them and we'll tell you what they said about the test. Then Anna Mateo will be with us, as she is every Sunday, with words and their stories. This week, she tells us about a strange tradition called April Fool's Day. And as we always do on the Sunday edition of Learning English Weekend, we will present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, we tell the story of 1918, the final year of the most terrible war the world had ever known. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the Voice of America. The new Scholastic Aptitude Test, or SAT, has arrived. Many colleges and universities use it as an entrance exam. In March, hundreds of thousands of high school students took the redesigned test. The exam is getting some positive reviews from some early test takers. High school students who took the test said the new SAT is more straightforward. John Russell reports.
The new exam focuses less on vocabulary words. It focuses more on everyday learning and analysis by students. On the old SAT, students lost points if they guessed the wrong answer. On the new SAT, students are not penalized for guessing. The College Board is the organization that produces the SAT. It says more than 463,000 test takers signed up to take the new SAT in March. This number is a small increase from a year ago. For now, the College Board is only offering the exam to students applying for scholarships and financial aid. The exam will be open to all students in May. The new SAT continues to test reading, writing, and math with an emphasis on analysis. Gone are some of those unusual vocabulary words. Test takers will see more common words used in the classroom. Students will have to show that they understand meaning in different contexts. In math, students will see more algebra and problem solving. they will no longer be tested on a wide range of math concepts. But the use of calculators is limited to certain questions. Overall, there are fewer questions, 154 on the new test, plus one for the essay. The old test had 171 questions. Students will have a choice about whether to write the essay. A perfect score goes back to 1,600 with a separate score for the essay. Brian Keyes is a third-year student at Woodrow Wilson High School in Washington, D.C. There aren't as many questions where it's trying to trick you. It was much more straightforward, he said. His classmate, Isabel Suarez, said, "I liked it better than the old one. I thought that it was way more applicable to what we've been learning in school. The English was a lot easier for me than it was with the old one." Suarez said she enjoyed the reading section. "My AP English class definitely really prepared me for it. I honestly enjoyed the grammar part because I like to pick out problems in writing. It was pretty fun, actually. AP stands for Advanced Placement. Students might test out of college courses if their grades and test scores from AP are high." This was the first change in the SAT since 2005. The head of the College Board says the new test has more familiar reading passages, vocabulary words, and math. David Coleman is the president and chief executive officer of the College Board. "The sum of the redesign of the test is to make it much more like the work that kids are already doing in high school," he said. Coleman added that the test was changed so that more students will feel like they have a chance to succeed. "With fewer questions on the new test," Coleman said, "there is more time for each of the reading and math questions." Lee Weiss is Kaplan Test Prep's Vice President of College Admissions Programs. He has some advice for students taking the new SAT. "If you've been preparing and putting in your study time, then you should go in confident. It's not the end of the world if you don't perform well," he said. Weiss says students should not skip the essay. Many of the top universities look at the essay. It is an important part of their admissions process. "Make sure you are writing a good, structured essay that answers the prompt," said Weiss. "Make sure that you are varying your word choice and your sentence structure." Ned Johnson is the president of Prep Matters, an SAT preparation company. He said students should not be too creative or artistic in their writing. Students should write in a clear, analytical style. Johnson says the math problems on the new test have a lot more words than before. The College Board has teamed up with online educator Khan Academy to offer SAT practice with the new exam for free to all students through quizzes and practice tests. The tests are available online. I'm John Russell.
Thanks, John. Now, if it's Sunday, it means Anna Mateo is here with one of our most popular programs, Words and Their Stories. This week, she tells us about fools and frauds.
And that brings us to the end of another Words and Their Stories from VOA Learning English. Just kidding. To kid, to tease, to joke and fool around. They all mean about the same thing. If you kid, you make fun in a playful way. Teasing can be playful or mean-spirited. It depends. To joke around is to have fun with someone. To fool someone is to try to make them believe something that is not true. And that is the purpose of April Fool's Day. April 1st is known as the day to fool people with practical jokes, pranks, or harmless tricks. But how did this tradition begin? Some say April Fool's Day began as one big mistake. Many centuries ago, people in the Western world used the Julian calendar. They celebrated the New Year on April 1st. However, when people began using the Gregorian calendar, the New Year was moved to January 1st. Those who forgot the change and tried to celebrate New Year's Day on the wrong date were teased and called April Fools. This is just one of the many theories behind the origin of April Fool's Day. But the tradition remains the same, trying to fool someone. The fool is a common character in art, music, and literature. William Shakespeare is famous for his fools, and fools make for great pop songs. Fools are found in many words, expressions, and proverbs. To be foolhardy means to do something that is too dangerous or risky. For example, it is foolhardy to hike up a mountain during a heavy snowstorm. If something is foolproof, it is planned or made so well that nothing could go wrong. Not even a fool could mess it up.
Look, I don't want to get into trouble. This plan of yours sounds risky.
My plan is foolproof. Nothing will go wrong as long as you do exactly as I say.
There are many expressions using the word fool. If you are on a fool's errand, you are doing something that is pointless. For example, asking a friend who has no money for a loan is a fool's errand. Fool's gold is iron pyrite. Iron pyrite is a brassy yellow mineral that is often mistaken for gold. Miners who did not know much about the properties of gold would often mistake iron pyrite for the real stuff. A fool's paradise is not a vacation spot for fools. It is a state of being happy for foolish or unfounded reasons. Here is an example.
Monica is so happy these days. She thinks she is getting a raise at work.
But she is always late. She misses her deadlines. And her boss doesn't really like her.
I know. She is living in a fool's paradise.
Even a smart and reasonable person can be a fool at times. You can be a fool for love, a fool for money, or a fool for success. Basically, you can be a fool for anything that causes you to lose control or lose touch with reality. In this song, Connie Francis sings that everybody is somebody's fool. Fools also find themselves in many common proverbs. For example, a fool and his money are soon parted. This means that if you are not careful with your money, you will soon not have any. Another proverb is, there is no fool like an old fool. This means if an older person behaves foolishly, it seems worse than when a younger person does the same. An older person should know better. Then there is the proverb, "Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me." This means that if you are tricked once by someone, they are to blame for fooling you. But if you let the same person fool you again, the blame is all your own. When George W. Bush was president, he infamously messed up this proverb in a speech. We end this show with yet another foolish proverb. Fools rush in where angels fear to tread. English poet Alexander Pope wrote this line in his 1709 poem, An Essay on Criticism. Songwriter Johnny Mercer turned it into a classic song.
Fools rush in where angels fear to tread.
I'm Anna Mateo.
So open up your heart and let this fool rush in.
Thanks, Anna. Now, as we do every Sunday, we present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, Larry West and Morris Joyce continue the story of President Woodrow Wilson and America's involvement in World War I.
1918 was the final year of the most terrible war the world had ever known. But World War I did not end quickly or easily. The German army made a final effort to defeat the Allies. The United States had entered the conflict, and Germany wanted a victory before large numbers of American troops could get to Europe. Germany's effort became easier after it signed a peace treaty with the new Bolshevik government in Russia. The treaty made it possible for Germany to use all its forces against the Allies on its western border. In the end, however, Germany's plan failed. Allied troops pushed back the German attack in a series of bloody battles. The addition of American soldiers greatly increased Allied strength.
The leader of American forces in Europe was General John J. Pershing. General Pershing used a weapon new to the world of war, air power. Airplanes were used first simply as eyes in the sky. They discovered enemy positions so ground artillery could fire at them. Then, they were used as fighter planes. They carried guns to shoot down other planes. Finally, planes were built big enough to carry bombs. General Pershing also used another new weapon of war, tanks. He put these inventions together for his battle plan against Germany.
Pershing's target was the Argonne Forest. It was a tree-covered area Germany had held since 1914. The forest was protected by barbed wire and by defensive positions built of steel and concrete. It was the strongest part of the German line. It also was the most important part. If Argonne fell, Germany's final lines of defense would fall. The fighting in the Argonne Forest was fierce. Thousands of men died. Sometimes troops got lost because the forest was so thick with trees. But day by day, the Allies pushed the Germans back.
Germany's leaders were losing hope. In September 1918, they met with German ruler Kaiser Wilhelm. The army chief reported that the war was lost. Germany had no choice, he said. It must give back all the territory it had seized and try to negotiate a peace agreement. Other officials told the Kaiser that the situation at home was bad, too. People were starving. Revolutionaries were plotting to overthrow the government. Kaiser Wilhelm agreed it might be best to seek peace now, before Germany was destroyed completely. He asked his foreign secretary to send a secret message to American President Woodrow Wilson. The message would propose immediate negotiations to end the war.
President Wilson received it. He did not tell the other Allied leaders. Instead, he returned a message to Germany. Wilson asked if Germany was willing to accept the peace proposals he had offered many months earlier. Germany's chancellor answered that his government did accept the proposals. However, the events of war ended the secret exchange of messages between Germany and the United States. German submarines had increased attacks on Allied shipping. 2 passenger ships were sunk. 820 persons were killed. Many were women and children. President Wilson was shocked. He told Germany there could be no peace negotiations with such an inhuman enemy.
In late October 1918, Wilson sent a final message to Germany. He wanted a settlement that would make it impossible for Germany to fight again. Germany, Wilson said, must promise to withdraw its forces from all Allied territory. It also must close its weapons factories. Wilson added that the Allies would negotiate only with a government that truly represented the people of Germany, not with military rulers. The new German chancellor was Maximilian, Prince of Baden. Prince Max received President Wilson's message. He succeeded in getting Kaiser Wilhelm to dismiss the man responsible for German military policy. But he failed to get the Kaiser himself to give up power.
Not all Allied leaders supported President Wilson's plan to end World War I. They could not agree on some parts of it. Britain, for example, opposed the part about freedom of the seas. Britain said it would prevent the kind of naval blockade which had been so effective against Germany. France and Italy opposed the part about creating a new international organization. Wilson had called it a League of Nations. To solve these differences, Wilson sent his closest advisor to Europe to meet with Allied leaders. The discussions were long and sometimes bitter. Many of the Allies thought Wilson was being too kind to the defeated enemy. But in the end, they all agreed to accept the plan as a starting point for peace talks.
By this time, in early November, the situation in Germany was growing worse. communists and socialists were calling for a rebellion. The Navy was ordered to go to sea. Sailors refused and killed some officers. Reports told of rebellion in parts of the German army, too. The nation's leaders had no choice. They would negotiate a peace treaty. On the morning of November 8th, a German delegation went to Allied military headquarters to discuss terms.
The Germans were met by the Supreme Allied Commander, Marshal Ferdinand Foch of France. Foch greeted them coldly, and he did not offer peace terms until they officially asked for a ceasefire. Germany, not the Allies, had to put down its weapons first. The Germans were shocked when they heard the terms. The list was severe. Among other things, Germany must withdraw its forces from all occupied territories. It must give up Alsace-Lorraine, a part of France it had held for almost 50 years. It must give up most of its weapons, including airplanes, submarines, and battleships. And it must turn over large numbers of trucks, railroad engines, and other supplies.
The German delegation said it could not sign such an agreement. Germany, it said, was not surrendering. It was only asking for a ceasefire. The delegation said it could not accept the peace terms without communicating with the government in Berlin. But the German government was falling apart. Kaiser Wilhelm had finally resigned and left the country. A new cabinet had been formed, and a new prime minister had declared a German republic. Yet the situation remained unsettled. Because of this, the German delegation negotiating with the Allies had to decide for itself. After much argument, the men agreed to the Allied terms. They signed the peace treaty. A ceasefire began a few hours later.
When news that the shooting had stopped was broadcast, people celebrated around the world. They danced in the streets. They cheered the end of the worst war in history. There were celebrations along the battle lines, too, but these were quiet. Soldiers from both sides climbed out of long trenches dug in the ground. They met the men who, a short while earlier, had been their deadly enemy. The bloody European conflict was over. The dispute, however, was not. Another fierce battle was ready to begin. This time, the battle would be among diplomats. The fight over the peace treaty, officially ending World War I, was about to begin. That will be our story next week on The Making of a Nation. Well, that's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. You can read and listen to the stories that you have heard on today's program on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from Washington. Jonathan Evans will be here tomorrow to help you learn everyday American English with As It Is Monday, the weekly Learning English broadcast, webcast, and podcast from the Voice of America.